Welcome to NASS Dialogues, the dialogue podcast focused on events and issues in school psychology. I'm Dan Florell, the NASP Online Communication Coordinator and moderator of our current dialogue. Today we're discussing, but I've tried everything, what to do when the interventions does not work. And we have the privilege of Dr. Matt Burns being here from the University of Missouri. Matt, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Dan.
So why don't we just start out and have you explain a little bit what you mean by a skill by treatment interaction? Sounds like a thrilling topic.
It is a thrilling topic. It's the process of using data among kids for whom interventions aren't working to see what type of modification or different intervention we should try. It's designed to help see, does this kid, are we doing the completely wrong intervention, or are we just need to modify the current intervention by maybe adding more practice, adding more modeling, or adding in perhaps an incentive to it as well.
So when you're describing this, it sounds like, okay, this is MTSS. Why are you calling it skill by treatment intervention?
No, it exactly is MTSS. So MTSS, it's exactly a part of MTSS. Mm-hmm. MTSS would be the system, the framework with which it is developed and implemented. The skill by treatment interaction, I argue, is how you identify tier two and tier three interventions.
Mm-hmm.
So tier two is sort of global, like, well, this kid needs decoding or this kid needs basic computation skills. And then tier three is, no, the kid needs to learn it in the first place or remember it better. So it's absolutely, MTSS is the delivery framework for this particular model.
But I think having listened to you at a few of your workshops, this is more of kind of a more laser-focused approach than I think you've talked about where some school districts might just have a one-size-fits-all approach.
Right. I actually argue that that's, if your district is using one tier two intervention, that's really not going to be effective for most of the kids, regardless if it's reading, math, or even behavior. So even at the tier two level, we want to target a little bit, but again, keeping it sort of at the gross level, decoding mm-hmm. versus fluency versus comprehension, for example. And then in tier three, really becoming precise, really diving in to see what's going on.
Great. So can you give an example of one intervention for each phase of learning?
Sure. So we use the learning hierarchy for this. And so we will do acquisition, which is trying to increase accuracy.
Mm-hmm.
Then the next phase is trying to increase the speed, the fluency with which you can do it. And that eventually leads to generalization. So for example, in reading, if I'm thinking of reading fluency, which is something most people are familiar with, the acquisition one will be a modeling one like something called duet reading,
mm-hmm.
where you and a student read together, but you read every other word and the student reads every other word.
Mm.
And that, so you read it through. You read first, student reads second, you read third, student reads fourth, and then you switch after reading the whole passage, and then student reads first, you read second, et cetera. And so that way, every word on that page is read or modeled for that kid. So that's a modeling intervention that's very much acquisition. Once they can read with high accuracy, then you switch to old-fashioned repeated reading. You have the kid read the passage as a cold read, read it three, four, five times, and then do the hot read to see how much they went up. And like for decoding, it would be explicit instruction in sounds, whereas for acquisition, whereas for proficiency, for fluency building, it would be practicing using the sounds to make words, using the letters to make words. You don't mm-hmm. teach what they say, you just practice using them to make words.
So that's an example of reading, and of course, for most of our listeners, that's probably the number one learning disability area. One of the trickier ones that we struggle with often is in regards to maybe something like writing.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any examples of writing ones that would apply to this kind of model? I know reading ones are a much more robust kind of literature.
Right. Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to say. So we've done research around reading and math.
Mm-hmm.
My team hasn't looked at writing, and few have. But it's the same kind of model. So you start off with the initial instruction in transcription, for example,
mm-hmm.
Teaching students, you model a particular letter, and this is how you make it. That's acquisition. That's getting accurate. And then once they can do it with accuracy, you have them practice writing it, just to practice writing the letter.
Mm-hmm.
That becomes the proficiency. Now, the thing that's nice about writing is generalization's built in. So you have to, in order to do this intervention, you have to then have them go write something that is an application of what they just learned. So writing actually builds in generalization better than does reading or math.
So for these three different phases in the skill by treatment interaction, you've already given some examples about reading, and we discussed writing briefly. Can you maybe expand upon how it applies in a math situation?
Sure. I just came from a symposium on this very topic. Within acquisition, cover, copy, compare. So cover, copy, compare is not designed to help the students get the math problems right more quickly. It's designed to help them get it right more accurately. I would argue incremental rehearsal will help them to get it right more accurately. Then once they can do it with 90% accuracy, then you switch to time drills. So that's when you give the kid the sheet and have them just do it for 2 minutes and see how many they can do. And if you do a time drill with a kid who's inaccurate, you could be doing more harm than good. So within math, we're going to get them accurate through cover, copy, compare, or incremental rehearsal, and then use a time drill to increase the speed at the second phase.
So the analogy I'm thinking of here in regards to your approach towards this is one of following a recipe for a pastry or something, mm-hmm. right? That you have to do things in a certain order, and you don't want to skip. So you don't want to shove the concoction you put in the oven and say, oh, we'll get to the eggs later, mm-hmm. right? We need to have everything where you build that basic skill and then you build it to a proficiency level and then it generalizes. Yep. You know, you got to take each of those steps in kind, and forcing it is going to just create a bunch of problems and frustration for everybody and probably misidentification, I would imagine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yes, that's a good analogy. So if you have a pie, or I forget the example you used, that doesn't taste good, didn't turn out well, it gives you a framework to go back and see what you did wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we'd rather do it right from the beginning, but oftentimes with students whom we're working, we don't really dive into it until we see the intervention isn't working.
Mm-hmm.
And it gives us a framework to go back and look to see, oops, we skipped the eggs.
Now, do you think it would be better then to try to more accurately from the very start then get it so that we identify, or is it better to kind of, and sometimes in MTSS, the idea of like the tier one, a general education is going to be good for most kids. Mm-hmm. We're not going to dive down for each individual child necessarily because of the resources involved in trying to spell out, okay, this child needs this, this needs this at a tier one general level. So where in that process would you recommend, after we're kind of in that tier one general education curriculum, that we would want to become as specific with that measure?
It depends. Well, so you do it at all three tiers. I'll mm-hmm. use the tier language. But the level of specificity and precision varies.
Mm.
So tier one, your problem analysis is there a class, is there a systems issue? And so it's really, there's no differentiating in intervention at tier one for within a classroom. But at tier two, now we'll do some differentiating, but it's going to be categorical. It's going to be phonemic awareness versus decoding versus fluency versus comprehension,
mm-hmm.
computation, it'll be that type of categorical. And then tier three is where you bring in the learning hierarchy, the acquisition, proficiency,
okay.
fluency. So it just depends on where in the sequence you are.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to, I know a lot of schools out there will use one tier two intervention. For example, the level literacy intervention, LLI. LLI is used by lots of schools in this country. So I'll tell a quick story. So I have an 80-pound golden doodle who's really fun, and he loves everything. And I take him for a walk, and he tries to drag me to every person that walks by, and he just loves the whole world. And every day he'll walk and just stop in his tracks. And there's some particular scent that's just caught his attention. And he'll spend 30, 40 seconds sniffing the ground to get the precise origin of that scent. And then he jumps up to go to pee on that spot, and he misses it by a foot every day. And I say to him, I don't expect an answer because he's a dog, but I say to him, why do you do that? Why do you spend 40 seconds finding the origin and then miss it by a foot? So if you're taking time to screen the reading skills of every student in your school, and it sometimes takes 20 or 30 minutes per kid, and then every kid gets the same intervention, like LLI, mm-hmm. you're doing the same thing. You're missing it by a foot.
Gotcha. Well, point well taken on that. And so this could explain when you have a very scientifically research-based intervention, let's say repeated reading, and it's doesn't work for some of those students. Are we to conclude that it's just a bad technique that we maybe don't need to use, or maybe your skill-by-treatment interaction does a much better job of explaining why it's successful for so many kids and maybe not some for others?
The reason I got interested in this work to begin with was when I was working in the schools, and we had a kid who might move in, and they had a particular type of problem, reading, math, or something, and the teachers and I look at it, and we say, wow, this is just like a kid like last year who had the same situation. We use this research-based intervention, and repeated reading is a great example of that. Mm-hmm. So that could be the most researched reading intervention ever. And so we'll try it with the kid, and even though it worked with the same similar kid last year, it didn't work for this kid. And my argument is it's not because it was a bad intervention, assuming they did the intervention the right way.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a bad intervention. It just didn't match what this kid needed. And so repeated reading, great intervention, dozens of studies on it. But if the child can't decode, repeated reading is not really going to help. And if the child reads with fluency, doesn't understand what they read, repeated reading is not going to help. But if they can decode adequately and have understand what they read, just lack basic fluency skills, repeated reading is the best thing to do.
Okay. And I think that helps clarify things because, of course, you know, the golden standard has always been put out. You want empirically based reading interventions, and, you know, if you identify a weakness, you use one of those. But it really has to have a lot more thought than just say, hey, this is for reading decoding. This kid seems to have reading decoding issues. Just stick it in there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a really good point. And I think that's what makes your approach kind of a next step from the basic understanding of what an MTSS or RTI type of model generically would provide, and what I see at least a lot being implemented in the schools. And it's almost like they're doing it by rote because it's just the road to the process of eventually qualifying for special education, which is, of course, what the old system also seemed to do. And we're really losing some of that opportunity if we're not doing more of this detail. And, of course, can make a profound difference, I imagine, on the student level. But when we talk about these types of interventions, it's almost always within an elementary framework. By that meaning that elementary students tend to be where the bulk of all these interventions are tried. It's where most of the teachers are going to be familiar with them. But what I'm curious with is, has this been studied in more like a high school population? Could you maybe comment a little bit about that?
Yeah, the research around STI for secondary, it mirrors the research around reading, math, et cetera, for elementary versus secondary. There are dozens and dozens of more studies at the elementary level for reading and math.
Mm-hmm.
We have done some studies, primarily at tier two, with an STI approach and saw significant effects, nice growth for reading. So I would argue that the framework of comprehension versus decoding versus fluency, we've got good research to suggest at the secondary level that really matters. And the intervention, maybe I shouldn't name an intervention, but there's an intervention commonly used that is a very comprehension-oriented intervention. And what we found is probably half the kids who struggle with reading at the secondary level, at the high school level, can't decode or can't read with fluency. If that's the case, that comprehension intervention is not going to help.
My question is, and I don't doubt that there are kids at that higher level that don't have that skill set that everybody assumes by the time you reach there, you have at least that. Is a lot of these interventions then almost seem like a childish because the interventions seem so geared to elementary. So do you want to go back and look, hop on POP, or, you know, obviously that's an extreme example, and with adolescents with their own kind of mentality of, you know, not wanting to be embarrassed, not feeling like they don't measure up, do you see some of those issues? I mean, is there programs that acknowledge that maybe we can have reading intervention where it's a topic that's not going to be an embarrassment to show how far behind you are because you've lacked some of these basic skills? Or is it a question of just being able to finally read and have it acknowledged and not be continually lost when people are sprinting by in your everyday curriculum that they don't care because it's just a thrill to be able to read?
I would argue both points are correct and not mutually exclusive. So I think you're right in that when kids learn how to read or do math or whatever, there's an excitement there, and they appreciate that. So we do a class-wide intervention based on the peer-assisted learning strategies model. And so we have them do paragraph shrinking at the high school level where they read a paragraph and then have to tell you the most important thing about that paragraph in 10 words or less. And so we first started doing this at high schools and middle schools. We would test it by having them put slash marks or something like that. But the elementary school, they have to say 10 words, so we just have them put a finger down for every word. And I thought that would be too babyish for mm-hmm. the high school and the middle school. But what we found was they did it. They did it on their own. They just put their finger down. And so that got us really thinking about that. But having said that, so I think you're right. So I think they do have it, just they want to learn. And so because of that, they're motivated to do things that I initially would have thought they probably wouldn't do. But having said that, though, I still think we need to focus on interventions designed explicitly for kids at the secondary level. Mm-hmm. So I'll plug a few if that's okay.
Yeah, sure.
Anita Archer's program Rewards is a decoding intervention written explicitly for kids in middle school and high school. And it doesn't look like a little kid intervention at all.
Mm-hmm.
You could do reciprocal teaching with, repeated reading. I'll come back to reciprocal teaching. Repeated reading with social studies science content from the secondary level.
Mm-hmm.
So you could take their science material from their science class and run a repeated reading program with that. And then I mentioned reciprocal teaching accidentally, but that's a comprehension intervention, again, explicitly for kids at the secondary level.
Mm-hmm.
And that one works so well that there's actually been some books that have taken it down to the elementary level, like fourth and fifth grade.
Mm.
But that's really designed for kids in the secondary level. So I think you're wise as an interventionist to look for those types of materials that are explicitly geared towards mm-hmm. them, and don't go to a website, download a third grade intervention and use mm-hmm. it with an eighth grader or ninth grader and expect them to respond well to it. Except I will say, if it works, even though I've seen some stuff that I questioned, would an older kid accept this? They have accepted it because it's worked and they learned how to read.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think those two points are mutually exclusive. Pick the stuff that is for secondary kids, but don't be surprised if they're willing to do things that appear out of their age group because it works.
Mm-hmm. I think it's a good point. Now, the flip side of the is, do you experience or have you seen teachers be more reluctant to try to intervene at those more basic levels, claiming that's what elementary teachers are supposed to do? I teach whatever subject it is.
Oh, that's an easy answer. Yes. Yes. So we've discovered a couple things. So when we were doing some diagnostic assessment, so all the kids who scored low on this group-administered measure of comprehension at a high school, ninth and 10th graders, we were going to pull them and do an oral reading fluency, a CBM, with them. And we showed the teachers how to do that, and there were 200 kids, and the teachers literally laughed at us and said, "You expect us to pull 200 kids one-on-one, have them read to us?" You know, that's a foreign concept at the high school level. At the elementary level, that's Tuesday.
Right.
So we found the test of silent contextual reading fluency. There's also the word reading efficiency test. These other types of group administered measures that get at reading fluency fairly well. So we worked with them to identify those types of measures that could be group administered that they could accept, and that was okay. And we discovered we could get them to do the intervention if we gave them the intervention and said, don't say do phonics, say do this Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday for half an hour, here's what you do. So when you give it to them like that, they're much more likely to implement it. So you can't just say to them, these kids need decoding, yeah, work on decoding with them, because that won't happen. But if you mm-hmm. say to them, do this 3-4 times a week, and by the way, doing that will help them access your curriculum. And if you can use the curriculum as the intervention or part of the intervention, which social studies and science lend themselves beautifully for that,
mm-hmm.
for reading and math, of course, There's a curriculum around math as well. Then we see that teachers at the secondary level are more likely to engage.
Okay. So it really is some of the framing of the techniques and maybe framing it in a different way than you would typically refer in an elementary kind of setting.
Right, exactly. Like. It's as much as how you present it as what it is.
Mm-hmm. So we've talked a little bit about high schools and applying this to that age. What about ELL populations? Are we seeing the same type of process, or do we have some unique aspects that we need to consider with that population?
And again, the answer to that is going to be yes to both. So we use the same process we use for kids who are English learners as we do English speakers, but we add some components to it. We pretty much always add, regardless of reading or math, add a vocabulary component to it. And what that vocabulary component looks like will vary based on age of the kid, et cetera. So for example, if we're doing repeated reading, because the kid needs fluency work, we will identify the key words in the reading passage beforehand, show them pictures of those key words, and talk about what that means.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a way you infuse ELL. Or a vocabulary into it for kids who are English learners. So my students and I did a mini skill on this topic this week. We do we take the STI approach, we collect the data, figure out what they need, but then because they're an English learner, we'll add in a vocabulary component. The only other thing we do differently is we treat vocabulary as its own category of intervention,
mm-hmm.
more so than we do for kids who are English speakers.
So I would say that you could also probably use this approach from individuals that maybe are coming from more high impoverished areas too, where there's kind of a documentation of a lack of vocabulary exposure, or I don't know if it's been applied in that way, but
it has.
Mm-hmm.
I would argue, and I'd probably need to think through the statement before I say it, because I haven't thought it through probably enough. A lot of kids who come to school from high poverty backgrounds don't look that different from English learners in terms of vocabulary, et cetera. Now, of course, English learners have more, I'm not comparing the level of need.
Mm-hmm.
I'm saying that there's some similarities there. And so we do often include vocabulary with students from poverty backgrounds as well.
I just think it's a nice consideration, you know, as we go further in, and particularly knowing really the context of the learners and what they're coming to school with. And sometimes we need to go a little bit beyond just the typical assumptions like age-based kind of issues.
Yeah, and to add to that, there's dozens of studies on phonemic awareness and the importance mm-hmm. of that in learning to read. But when you look at it and dive into it, most of the literature, almost exclusively, was conducted with a bunch of middle-class white kids.
Hmm.
So we replicated one of the studies with kids from poverty background and saw that rhyming as an early phonological awareness skill did not predict reading very well at all.
Hmm.
So that changed how we worked with kids who are, from poverty backgrounds. So we would try and teach rhyming, but they don't learn it. We move on and move to blending and segmenting and manipulating and all that, and don't hold back for them to learn how to rhyme because we saw that did not predict reading growth.
Hmm. Wow, that's really interesting. So, you know, this is a really nice bit of information, and I think it would enhance the effectiveness of a lot of the interventions that we would be trying in the schools. So is this something that you could use to write IEP goals?
It is. One thing, we're doing a symposium on this. We just finished a study on this, I should say. And we looked at psych reports. And in my opinion, this would be my opinion, a well-written psych report should translate easily into IEP goals.
Mm-hmm.
And so we work with practitioners and my students and so on to see that there are data that exist in most reports. I'm not talking about an IQ test. Or easy to get, where you can help to isolate this. So, for example, if the school does screening using CBM, using oral reading fluency, all you have to do is compute accuracy and the fluency. So if the benchmark is 60 words a minute and the kid's reading 30, well, then you know he's low in fluency. Now you look at the accuracy, and if he's reading 30 words a minute and he's only reading 80% of the words accurately, then that's an indication he probably needs decoding.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, the data we either collect typically as part of a psych eval or the data that exists in the school can easily be used to frame recommendations and syntheses of the data and recommendations that could easily translate into IEP goals. And part of the reason I think this is important is that's what I think school psychology should be. Like, we should be the ones that teachers can turn to and say, I've tried everything. What do I do? Mm-hmm. And we could be the ones to dive in and have a framework to analyze those data to increase student success. And once a child's in special ed, then presumably at some point in time, that process has already happened. Someone's already said, this kid's needs are so severe. We've tried everything. What do we do? And so if that's the case, then that is the case. School psychs can be the ones that have a framework to help inform those decisions.
So I think you've already addressed this to some extent, but as far as kind of school psychologists in their everyday job, how do they implement this? Obviously, you just talked about how they may be able to implement it within a report based on some of the information that hopefully has been already gathered on that student. Do you have other examples of how this STI or skill by treatment intervention might be able to be utilized by school psychologists?
Yeah, and I'm glad this question was asked and therefore answered on a podcast, because when I give this answer to a room of school psychologists, it's usually not well received. The best thing I think to do is, once the screening data are collected, to when the teachers meet or whatever team meets to analyze those data, the school psychologist should be at that meeting. And so they can help guide the decision-making using a framework like the one we've talked about, and that can help guide tier two interventions. School psychologists, I think, should be part of problem-solving teams. In fact, I've done studies that have shown problem-solving teams are more effective if school psychologists are on them. So, and then they take this STI framework, and what I propose is that before the meeting occurs, the problem-solving team meeting occurs, the school psychologist meets with the referring teacher in a consultative relationship, analyzes the data, and comes to the meeting able to say, this kid's struggling with decoding, and they're in the acquisition phase of decoding. And that reduces a lot of the time spent in problem analysis, and therefore you're ready to dive into suggesting solutions. So I just said that I think school psychologists should participate in more meetings, and that's when crowds get angry. but the thing I'll say is that when you do that, the number of referrals to special ed go down. And in my experience, it's just my one person, but I actually kept the data. As a practitioner, I saw a 25% reduction in referrals every year. And so if you can, and I'm not going to lie, the first year is hard, but if you can do that and be part of those meetings, your job will change. And I assume, therefore, will be more consistent with the type of role you probably want.
Well, and when you were talking about the consulting with the teacher prior to the meeting, I'm curious, would you recommend them having, hopefully, the teacher take the lead in regards to the conclusion? You know, we talk a lot about empowering our consultee when we do a consultation, with maybe the goal being, once you do work with them in a one-on-one, maybe longer term, you're not having to do nearly as much. Maybe you even come into that one-on-one after, say, 9 months of working with them, and they already have that already analyzed and said, oh yeah, this is just like the other kid, and we see this same pattern, and you just,
That happened in Pennsylvania. So in Pennsylvania, with the instructional support team model, they, and I'm making these numbers up, so this is all from memory, but the number of kids referred to the instructional support team, you know, once they started it, went up pretty significantly from year one to year two. And then, I won't try and give numbers because this is from memory, and then the subsequent years, it went down. The referrals to the IST went down. And so once the folks in Pennsylvania saw this, they tried to figure out what's going on, and the conclusion was, after talking to other teachers, they didn't need to go to the IST anymore. They knew how to do it on their own.
Mm-hmm.
So our job is to give away our skill.
Right.
And if we work with teachers in that consultative model, empower them to walk them through the process, they understand it, then they become better at implementing it.
Well, it's definitely an excellent approach and technique, certainly well-researched. But of course, there's never finished. There's always new areas. I mean, we alluded and talked a little bit about writing and the writing interventions that still need to be done. But what is the future direction of the skill by treatment research?
So, yes, you mentioned writing, and I have some students about to begin dissertations that will likely focus on the application of this to writing.
Mm-hmm.
We also have started working on the application of it to kids with cognitive impairments. Is the relationship between fluency and comprehension, for example, the same with a child who has cognitive impairment as it is for a child who doesn't? I don't know the answer to that. So so we are now trying to take this and apply it to kids who are into, you know, ID, you know, who have low IQs, et cetera, and to see, does the framework apply or do we have to make a change to it? And we're just starting that research, so that'll be exciting. That'll be cool. We're diving more deeply to kids who are EL. And trying to go into the more generalization type skills like reading comprehension and word problem solving.
Mm-hmm. Well, when you're talking about that, one of the things that I'm really intrigued by is one of the complaints, of course, I don't know about complaints, but the changing perspective regarding MTSS was, it doesn't matter what a child's intelligence level is, we're going to intervene in the same way. And I've heard that over the years, and why IQ does not belong in our jobs as school psychologists. And so, to me, when you look at intellectual disabilities or cognitive deficits, with what you're looking at, maybe we can really get a definitive answer of at what point does something like an intellectual disability interfere with well-regarded, researched interventions. And so I'm intrigued. I don't know if you have any inkling of what you're going to find, or you're not going to commit because you're you're like, let's see the research first.
Exactly.
But we all have hypotheses, and so it would be interesting to kind of, I guess, what your inclination or guess might be of where that goes, or maybe there isn't.
Well, I do think that we'll see. I'm not going to predict, but if there is an inconsistency in the theory for kids with intellectual disabilities, it's that they might learn some of the rote skills, but not have the language to get to the point where they need to be to comprehend, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a hunch what we'll see is, and I don't think the causal mechanism will be IQ per se. I think that'll just be the framework that we use to say, yeah, that's true with these kids. But my prediction is we'll have to infuse more background knowledge, vocabulary, language type issues with any intervention we do with kids with cognitive impairments, but haven't done the study yet, so
right,
we'll find
right.
out soon.
Well, it's something to look forward to when we drag you back in here in a few years and you'll have all the answers to that as part two, right? So we're getting ready to wrap up our podcast, but I want to give you an opportunity if there's any takeaways that you would like our listeners to have from kind of the things that we've discussed today.
Yeah, that school psychologists have a skill set that most teachers don't have. And just our appreciation of, knowledge of, and ability to apply data to solve particular problems is what makes us unique. And if we have a framework with which we can help kids for whom teachers have said, I've tried everything I can try, then teachers will see quite a bit of value in what we have to offer.
Well, I'd like to thank you, Matt, for joining us today. And that's going to conclude this Dialogues podcast. Please tune in again for future Dialogue podcasts available on the NASP website.